Karen Hartglass. You call in at 888-873-4643. We were at the second annual Veggie Pride Parade this past weekend, and it was a really great event. Lots of people turned out. There were exhibitors with all kinds of wonderful information. I had an opportunity to interview Mariana Thiem of the Netherlands Party for the Animals, the first Party for the Animals. And she was there for the premiere of the documentary Meet the Truth. That's Meet, M-E-A-T, Meet the Truth. And I got an opportunity to watch it, and it was really, really an exciting day. I have a guest with me today. It's Dr. Richard Schwartz, who's the Professor Emeritus of the College of Staten Island. He's the author of several books, Judaism and Vegetarianism, Judaism and Global Survival, and Mathematics and Global Survival. He's also the President of Jewish Vegetarians of North America, with a website at jewishveg.com. And he's the associate producer of a wonderful documentary. We'll talk a little bit more about it today, A Sacred Duty, the website asacredduty.com. I'd like to welcome Richard Schwartz.
Thanks a lot, Karen. It's great to be with you.
Great. Thank you for being with me today.
My pleasure.
So let's get right to it. How did you make the connection between Judaism and vegetarianism?
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay, now the connections, Judaism and vegetarianism, well, basically a few connections. First, God's first dietary regimen, according to the Bible, is right in the first chapter, chapter 1, verse 29 in Genesis, is strictly vegetarian, actually a vegan diet. And all the great commentators agree this was God's intention, and we don't use it as proof, but in chapter 5 of the Bible, that's when people live far, far longer, you know, longest lives, and that changed after the flood when permission reluctantly was given to eat meat. And also the other ideal time, besides the Garden of Eden, the Messianic period that Jews yearn for, is also pictured as vegetarian, based on a prophecy of Isaiah, that indicates, among other things, that the wolf will dwell with the lamb, the lion will destroy with the ox, and no one shall hurt nor destroy in all of God's holy mountain. But the main case is in six very, very important mandates in Judaism, and actually all the religions, you know, they all have similar teachings. And these six mandates are to treat animals with compassion, to take very good care of our health, to be co-workers with God in protecting the environment, in conserving natural resources, and helping hungry people, and seeking and pursuing peace. So all of these are very sharply violated by animal-based diets and agriculture.
Well, how did you personally make the connection? Were you vegetarian? Were you brought up vegetarian?
No, far from it. I was a big, big meat eater. Mother would always make me pot roast when I came over. I always got the quote-unquote drumstick for Thanksgiving. But I've been teaching mathematics at the College of Staten Island, and when you teach liberal arts and science students, it's a bit of a problem. They're poorly motivated and poorly prepared, but they have to take one course. So I got this idea of relating math to environmental issues. I really pioneered giving a course called Math and the Environment, and now it's become much more popular. But in that course, the idea was to relate basic math, a little bit of probability and statistics, calculations, graphs, to many of the issues, pollution and energy and all that. And one year we were discussing world hunger, and at first I thought, well, it's unfortunate, there's just too many people in the world, we can't feed them all. And then I read this book you're probably familiar with by Frances Morrow Pei.
Right, Diet for a Small Planet.
Where she points out how wasteful animal-based diets are, that, for example, we're feeding 70% of the grain in the U.S. to animals destined for slaughter, and some say as much as 40% of the grain worldwide to animals, farmed animals, while 20 million people are dying of hunger and its effects every year. Close to a billion are chronically malnourished. And so, you know, I just have discussions with the students. You know, we could cut world hunger if we change our diet. And after a couple of years of that, I took my own advice, gave up red meat, and the more I found out, I kept moving and became a vegetarian and pretty much a vegan today.
Now, were you well versed in Judaism at that time?
Well, to a certain extent. I pointed out many times that, say the least, there are people that know more about Judaism than I do, and there's people that know more about some of the environmental issues. But through that course, Math and Environment, I found out a lot about the environmental connections. I've often felt that the most important thing in religion is, can we use its messages to respond to the crises of the day? So I had enough of both to make a bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And my philosophy is always get things down, get it to a lot of people, get all kinds of criticism and all, and put it all together. But thank God the case is so strong. And I was able to, quote unquote, in effect, stand on the shoulders of giants, you know, and use quotations. If I came from out of the blue and said, you know, I think Jews should be vegetarians, that's one thing. But when you're quoting the scriptures and previous Jewish teachers, because I don't think anybody can deny that every religion stresses compassion and stresses sharing and justice and taking care of our health, being concerned, you know, being stewards of the environment. So the case was very powerful, and you know, I just really delved into it very strongly and took advantage of comments from others and all. And
you really bring up some very good points. And so religion is supposed to be related to compassion.
Absolutely.
And we read that in all the religions, and yet religion seems to be one of the major causes of war, and I don't see where that's related to compassion. But you know, when you bring up these different specific parts in the text in the Bible, how is it that those that are religious and study this information in great detail, how is it they miss that? How is it they're in denial about that?
Well, unfortunately, it's always been a battle between the prophetic and the priestly, and often the priestly seems to win out. You know, the prophets were the greatest critics of society, the greatest champions of social justice, and they would criticize everybody from the kings and leaders and everything, but many people go with a ritual and stress that, and they forget about the social justice and aspects of things. This is why, probably never complete it, but if I write a third book, because I have the two Judaic books, you mentioned Judaism and Vegetarianism, Judaism and Global Survival, my third book would be titled They Stole My Religion, because you know, the failure of religion to respond to what I'm saying. I'm not saying let's start a new religion or change religions, whatever. I'm saying let's put into practice these teachings. You mentioned compassion, and in the Psalms it says that God's compassion is over all of his creatures. The book of Proverbs indicates that the righteous individual considers the lives of his or her animals. And there's many, many teachings of that type. And if a person has an animal, he's supposed to make sure that the animal's needs are met, that the animal is fed before sitting down to his or her own meal, for example. I mean, there's a lot of these teachings. So that's what we're trying to get out. And I'm trying to get a respectful dialogue debate on a question, should Jews be vegetarians? Should religious people in general, should everybody be vegetarian? And, of course, certainly should, and especially today, when the world is threatened as never before, heading toward an unprecedented catastrophe, as you know, from global warming and other environmental threats. And I'm using the phrase more and more, it's really madness and sheer insanity.
Yeah.
You know, we're heading toward disaster, and yet we're trying to feed not only the present 6.8 billion people in the world today, but at least 60 billion farmed animals are raised for slaughter every year. And according to a UN FAO report, Food and Agricultural Organization report, the number of farmed animals projected, if current rates continue, current trends continue, to double in 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see that
there's no room on the planet for all of those beings, for that number.
Absolutely. But even today, it seems like almost every other day we see about the wildfires in California, and there's droughts in California, and to Australia. Israel now is the worst drought in its history.
Right.
Flooding and storms, and we know the polar ice caps are melting, the glaciers are melting, polar bears and many other species are in danger. So they say it's madness and sheer insanity that we're continuing this, especially when, as you say, the religious teachings are there. It's a matter of challenging them to put it into practice.
Maybe you could explain something to me. I was raised in a Jewish family, and I've chosen to take a more agnostic approach. I don't follow any traditions at this point in my life. But when it comes to following the kosher laws, this was something I was always a little bit confused about. Is it true that in order for meat to be kosher, all the blood has to be removed from it?
Well, that is the ideal, is that all the blood has to be moved, because, you know, Jewish tradition, they say the blood is the life, and we're not supposed to be eating the blood, and that's why there's an attempt at that. All the blood is drained, and they use salt to try to get out additional blood, and some have pointed out it's impossible, 100%.
That's my point, and
yeah,
that's why I always thought that was one of those little riddles that was included, that you could have meat if you could remove all the blood, but you can't remove all the blood, and
right.
So the message is we shouldn't be eating meat.
Well, no, absolutely, and all that, but see, what I'm doing, though, working within a Jewish tradition, our case is super, super strong, so it's like, you know, like you're playing baseball, you have to use the ground rules. These are some of the things, the interpretations, and rabbis have determined that if 99% of the blood is removed, that is sufficient, and so I agree, it can't be removed, but we have these other very powerful arguments, because Judaism does, by the way, put animals not at the same level as humans, because it does say that the very first chapter of Genesis, only human beings are created in God's image, but this certainly does not give us a license. Even the idea of dominion, it's also in that first chapter, is interpreted by the sages as responsible stewardship.
Absolutely. You know, it doesn't mean that we can confine them in healthy, horrible conditions.
Oh,
it doesn't
absolutely.
Mean that they can't have their own life and raise their own families, and it doesn't mean any of that. And yet, what happens with raising of kosher meat? I've heard some really horrible stories, and that's where the animal's supposed to be raised compassionately and slaughtered compassionately.
Well, actually, unfortunately, almost all the animals, as you know, are raised on factory farms under horrible, horrible conditions. I mean, the male chicks at the egg-laying hatcheries, as you know, are just have no use. They can't lay eggs. They haven't been genetically programmed to get have much flesh, so they are killed, you know, very cruelly right away. And of course, the egg-laying hens are in such close, confined spaces they can't even raise a wing. And instead of saying, gee, we better solve the problem, the terrible, terrible thing of de-beaking. So it's just animals in general. That's why when people say, well, we have shechita, the so-called Jewish ritual laws of slaughter, which were designed to minimize pain. But I say, even assuming that, what about the months and months of very cruel treatment on a factory farm? So this is definitely in violation of what in Hebrew is called Tzar Bar Chayim. It's a mandate not to cause any unnecessary injury to any animals, so that if, God forbid, if somebody was stranded on a desert island and they would either starve to death or eat an animal, Judaism would say then, under that very, very, very unusual conditions, a person could kill an animal. But, of course, we know 99.99999% of the time, it's not only unnecessary, but it's harmful to our health. Certainly, raising animals, terrible, terrible for the environment. You know, 60 billion animals, as I said, raised every year, and all the grain is fed to them. And, of course, you need far, far more water, which is 14 times as much water for a person on a typical American animal-based diet than for a vegan, no animal products at all. And this is in the age of the century of drought, as some people have called it. And once again, it's like madness and sheer insanity. We've just got to get this message out, because the survival of the planet depends on it.
Yeah, I agree with you. It is pretty insane, and it gets crazier and crazier. So when I talk to people and I mention this this verse in the Bible, 1:29 in Genesis, and the immediate response is, oh, well, God commanded man to eat meat after the flood.
We didn't command. He did give permission.
He got permission.
Which is a big, big, big difference. So I always say, unfortunately, I can't say, well, here it is right here in Deuteronomy or Exodus or whatever. Here's a verse that says, thou shalt not eat meat. Although I just came out with an article with that title just to stir things up. it may be in today's age, maybe God would have said that because, you know, I say the future of humanity.
Well, what was, I mean, I don't, I'm not going to play God here, but what was God's intention when he said, when he gave permission to eat meat?
Okay, well, the way I see it, it's that God didn't create us as angels, and he's given us a certain amount of free choice. Somebody has a book called God in Search of Man. And what he's saying is God is searching for the righteous individual. You know, he could say, well, we're all angels, and then there'd be no choice, and everybody would be fine. But here we have, we're striving to get back, in effect, to the, you know, symbolically to the Garden of Eden, to striving for a better world. And, you know, there's a lot of negatives. And, oh, look at the warfare, look at the slavery throughout history, and the genocide, and...
That's right. They use the Bible to condone slavery in this country, right?
At a point, although at least they said if a person had a Hebrew slave, it was like having a master, because just like with animals, you had to provide for the slave before yourself and make sure the slave was fed and all that. But still, so some of these things were part of the times, you know, that moving forward, instead of saying, well, here it is, people were not always ready to make leaps and all, so we hope that people evolve, and certainly moving to vegetarianism today would be a step forward. So God did not make us as angels. He's given us a choice. He's given us the potential, the wisdom to know. And yet, you know, I quote Al Gore sometimes when he quips, denial is not just a river
in Egypt.
Yeah, it's
I love that phrase.
Yeah.
Yep.
There's denial, there's resistance. You mentioned our movie, Sacred Duty, and it's very powerful, and given us a lot of friends, some relatives, and people just don't want to see it. They just don't want to know. You know.
So how did you get started with this movie, A Sacred Duty?
Okay, what happened is I was at a conference, a summer fest, so-called, the North American Vegetarian Society.
Sure.
And there they were showing this very nice movie that the Christian Vegetarian Association put together, a nice half-hour movie with nice quotes and all, and they were asking for comments, and I said, really commended it and said, you know, I wish the Jewish vegetarians in North America could do something like it. Now, I'm president of the Jewish Vegetarians in North America and the editor of their newsletter, and I'm constantly sending out ideas. Why don't we try this? Why don't we try that? And unfortunately, people are busy, and often things just fall and are forgotten. But I put in this idea. I said, gee, I saw this movie, Christian Vegetarian Association put together. Maybe we can do something like it. And very, very thankfully, somebody who I didn't even know was on the list, a wonderful person, Lionel Friedberg, out in Woodland Hills near Los Angeles in California, responded. He is a multi-award-winning producer, director, writer, cinematographer, and... still, you know, some years in his career, but maybe toward the end of it, and he said, yeah, we got to do this, and I'm going to help and everything, and it was a really wonderful job. He did it as a labor of love and dedication, not one penny of professional fee, otherwise we just couldn't afford it.
Well, I want to talk a lot more about this film, but I want to say first a few things. One is I saw it, and it was excellent. And we can't have enough of these types of works. We need more. We need to flood the world, the market, with DVDs and tapes and programs about this because it's so important. But what I want to say is there are a number of works out there that aren't very good, and the quality isn't very good. And I don't know anybody that would want to watch them. And this is not one of them. That it's really very professional. It showed. It was an excellent, excellent piece.
Yeah. Well, as I say, thank God we had this Ronald Friedberg. He put in so much time on it. And the issues are so important that we're giving these away freely. We've given away over 20,000. We got on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
If people go to, it's a simple thing, the title of the movie, A Sacred Duty, oneword.com, they can see the whole movie. And there's also versions there with subtitles in like a dozen languages, including Hebrew and German, Spanish, Arabic, etc., etc. And so they can see the entire movie. They can also request a complimentary copy, because we want this to be seen as widely as possible. You mentioned the Veggie Pride Parade. I gave out hundreds there. Just trying to get it to people. Hopefully they'll see it. They'll arrange a showing. They'll get it to other people. You know, we try to get it to rabbis and all. And by the way, the subtitle is like Applying Jewish Values to Help Heal the World. So it's from a Jewish perspective, but it has a universal message. And thank God we've gotten very favorable responses from the Christian and other religious communities. Mm-hmm. And people can also see blurbs and reviews at asacredduty.com, as well as questions and answers related to the movie and why we made it.
So what has the response been to from the traditional Jewish community? Have many of them had an opportunity to see it? Have you been there when some of them have viewed it?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, there's three groups in a way. I can break it down. First, I appreciate your kind words, and thank God that's been a response of many, many in the vegetarian animal rights community who see it as a valuable tool. So it really tries to be very positive. And what it does, by the way, is the first half is mainly about environmental threats, and the second half is where we bring out the vegetarian message, and especially toward the end, how terribly, terribly animals are treated. And we had a lot more in that, but we thought maybe it was just too much, but it certainly makes the point. So we try to get people hooked on it before bringing out the vegetarian message, which is in the second half. So that segment loves it. But unfortunately, as I said before about denial, it's hard to break through, but there have been wouldn't say many, but a number who said, gee, I saw it, I'm now a vegetarian. And also, we have made a breakthrough. I mean, nobody's been able to say, well, it's terrible, I disagree, and here's my reasons, you know, with any really authenticity of any kind. So, but it's hard. We're trying to get it, of course, to others, as many people as possible, but people don't want to know, and that's unfortunate, because it's just not a matter of, well, as I've been saying recently, vegetarianism, of course, is a very important individual choice, but it's now become a societal imperative, imperative, because, as you know, the world cannot much longer sustain the tremendous wastefulness and inefficiencies and negative environmental effects, etc., of animal-based diets and agriculture.
When my sister and I were growing up, we used to joke and say that religion was all about food.
Mm-hmm.
And this show is actually called It's All About Food, because, you know, all the holidays are centered around bringing the family together and
absolutely
having some wonderful traditional foods, and it's lovely.
Absolutely.
But some of those foods, brisket, gefilte fish, chicken soup with matzo balls.
Yeah.
How can people live without those things?
Well, you know, the diet famous nutritionist Nathan Pritikin said something like, if the enemies of the Jewish people designed their diet, they couldn't have done a much better job than what the Jews have done themselves. And when you mention that food, you know, there's a joke. Jews say about the at the holidays, what's involved? They tried to kill us. We foiled their efforts. Let's eat.
Right.
That's the thing on that. So, yeah, the foods are important. But it is incredible that because to take care of our health is arguably the most important mitzvah or commandment in Judaism. And I say that because, number one, of course, if a person is not healthy, they can't serve God in the way that Judaism would like them to, but also it overrides other important commandments. For example, the Shabbat, or the Sabbath day, is very, very important, of course, in Judaism. And, you know, it's meant to get away and be able to meditate and therefore not use a computer or phone or car and all that, you know. And plus, the whole world, by the way, needs a sabbatical, and as we keep destroying the world. But anyway, if God forbid a person is very ill on Saturday, on the Sabbath,
mm-hmm.
person can say, well, gee, I'm a religious Jew, I'm not allowed to use a car, etc. In only 3-4 hours, the Shabbat will be over, then I can call the hospital, then I can take you to the hospital, whatever. You know, Judaism says the laws are to live by, and not, God forbid, to die by, so that everything possible has to be done, even if it violates the Sabbath, even if it means eating on Yom Kippur when Jews are supposed to fast.
Right.
It overrides just about...
Which is comforting that there's some sensibility in the commandments.
Yeah.
So there's one commandment, thou shalt not kill. And I've frequently thought about what the meaning of that is. Like, does it mean thou shalt not kill Jewish people? Does that mean thou shalt not kill men, but it's okay to kill women? Thou shalt not kill the people you like, but not the people you don't like? Or does it mean thou shalt not kill, and that means all life on earth?
Right. Actually, in addition to the books I mentioned, I have by now about 140 articles at a website, which is jewishveg.com. And if you stop there, that's the Jewish Vegetarian of North America website. But if you have jewishveg.com/Schwartz, S-C-H-W-A-R-T-Z, about 140 articles and 20 podcasts that have other interviews of mine and talks I've given and things like that. And one of the articles is entitled, Is It Thou Shalt Not Kill or Thou Shalt Not Murder? Actually, the Jewish view is it's thou shalt not murder, or you could say thou shalt not kill unnecessarily, because, I mean, if it's a matter of self-defense, for example, or capital punishment, and Judaism puts very stringent conditions. It was a set of a Sanhedrin, if one person was put to death in many, many years, I forget the exact details, it would be like a hanging jury. And so anyway, but it does not forbid capital punishment, and or as I said, if God forbid a person was starving, there was no alternative. But the thing is, if you say thou shalt not kill unnecessarily, or murder, then still, because Judaism teaches we can only harm an animal or kill an animal if it meets an essential human need that can't be met in any other way. Like I said, if it's a matter of either you're going to starve or you're going to eat this animal, so you say that's like the one in a billion or trillion or whatever. So it certainly is not necessary to eat meat, because we know now that not only can we be sustained have good nutrition on plant-based diets, but we know how very, very harmful animal-based diets are. So we can't just say thou shalt not kill, and it includes animals, but we can say, I think, thou shalt not kill animals unnecessarily. And that's almost in every case, because it's destroying human health. And as you know, the U.S. now has tremendous problems with debts and deficits and all, and a major part of that is the soaring health expenditures, which has gone up from 5%, now it's like 17% of the total of all expenditures and rising, and that's what most of the concern is now. How do we pay for it? What kind of insurance? Single payer seems great to me, but there's very, very little talk about preventing the diseases in the first place.
Right. Well, let's talk about this further. I just want to say I'm speaking with Richard Schwartz, and we're talking about Judaism and vegetarianism. I'm Karen Hartglass with EarthSave International, and this is all about food. You can call in with questions at any time at 888-873-4643. Okay. So we were talking about
the health aspects, among others.
Right. You know what I wanted to bring up? I wanted to talk a little bit about the force feeding for mm-hmm. foie gras
right.
and the animal pâtés for ducks and geese. Mm-hmm. And I remember a few years back that Israel had passed some legislation mm-hmm. that in a certain, what is it, by 2012 or something, they would stop the manufacture mm-hmm. of this. Can mm-hmm. you talk a little, are you familiar with that?
Yeah. Actually, Israel has some strong laws about protection of animals and all. And unfortunately, some perspectives, it took the secular Supreme Court. You know, I've been talking about all these religious teachings and all, but unfortunately, that didn't seem to help. But the Supreme Court said, well, this is in violation of the animal welfare laws in Israel, so they did outlaw it. And I forget the years when it's supposed to start and all, and hopefully they'll be enforcing that. And, you know, other areas, I think California also has banned it, maybe that's starting in 2012, maybe something like that. So, I mean, definitely, I mean, that's one example. And, of course, we do show that in the movie A Sacred Duty, that, you know, madness and sheer insanity, I mean, to what we're doing to these animals, creatures of God, and to create a quote-unquote delicacy that's so, so unhealthy, super fatty and all that. And
it's crazy, and it's especially crazy because you can have a vegetarian chopped liver or vegetarian mm-hmm. foie gras. My mother makes a great recipe with string beans, walnuts, mm-hmm. and onions, and mm-hmm. it is phenomenal. So there's really no reason you can have your chopped liver and eat it too.
And of course, what you're saying is true about many, many vegetarian or vegan products that maybe years and years ago it was a big sacrifice, but now some of the dishes, you know, if you didn't tell a person, they'd think they were eating the actual meat products.
That's right.
Products and all. So, and there's so much more, as you know, in the health food stores and the supermarkets. And so a person can be very well nourished on it, and without the negatives of the saturated fat and the cholesterol and the lack of fiber and all, you know. So there's another example of the madness and sheer insanity. We said 70% of the grain in the U.S. fed to animals destined for slaughter. So we're taking the very nutritious corn and soy and oats and other grains that are rich in fiber and complex carbohydrates and converting them into a product where we're losing even most of the protein, and we're losing almost 100% of the fiber and almost 100% of the complex carbohydrates. And we're adding all the cholesterol and saturated fat, and that's why, in addition to everything else, I started to argue that medical practice today can be considered malpractice unless they let people know about how a good, well-balanced vegan diet can reduce the risk of disease, can ease disease once a person has it, and in many cases reverse it, as you know, as Dr. Dean Orne has shown with heart disease.
And diabetes. You can reverse adult onset diabetes.
Type 2 diabetes, right.
So you were mentioning all the grains that we're growing to feed animals and how inefficient it is. In addition, another reason not to do that is we could use a lot less farmland to grow plants to feed people.
Absolutely.
And we could feed more people, and we'd still have additional land left over that we could use for lots of different things. We could do more organic farming and rotate the fields and nourish the soil and take care of the soil instead of depleting it and making a dead soil that soon won't grow anything. Mm-hmm. We could have more wooded lands, forests, and animal sanctuaries.
Of course, we're destroying the tropical rainforest at a very rapid rate. You know, and these are the lungs of the world. That's where at least half of the species of plants and animals reside. And there might be, in some of these plants that we haven't even cataloged yet, and not even be aware they're there, there could be cures for cancer or AIDS or other dread diseases. So that's another example of the madness and sheer insanity that comes down. Of course, when we burn these tropical forests, which they often do, that adds carbon dioxide again to the atmosphere, and we're destroying trees that are a sink that can absorb some of the carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this, I want to emphasize, again, why, as I said before, we're heading toward this unprecedented catastrophe, because carbon dioxide levels are going up, and all the things we mentioned before about the droughts, about the floods, the melting of the polar ice caps and the glaciers, all of this is due to the fact that there's been an increase of less than 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit in the last 100 years or so, and the projections by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is really the UN group with the world's most prestigious climate scientists from all over the world, and a very conservative group. They have to come up with a consensus, but they, every 5-6 years, come up with a report where they're more and more certain that it's happening and it's going to have more and more serious consequences. They have been projecting an increase of anywhere from 3 to 11 degrees Fahrenheit in the next century.
Mm-hmm.
And if that happens...
If we make it.
Yeah, well, if that happens, it's hard to see with all that's happening now with, because the polar ice caps and glaciers have been melting far faster than even the worst of the projections.
The projections are interesting, they're frightening, but they always talk about what's going to happen in the next 50 to 100 years, and I don't think we have that time.
Mm-hmm.
I think we really need to be working today,
yeah,
next year, in the next 10 years, definitely. If we don't start turning around what we're doing, we're not going to see the next century.
Because James Hansen, one of the outstanding climate scientists from NASA, and others, and of course Al Gore said it as well, is that we could reach a tipping point where things could spiral out of control within just a few years unless changes are made. So I agree with you. A lot of people say, well, maybe for my grandchildren it'll be a problem, but not right now. But it's happening now. There's islands that have already been inundated. Somewhere in the Bay of Bengal, a whole island was overflooded, and people had to leave for another island, which is on track for also being flooded soon. So things are happening, and the governor of California has said the drought there is so severe that wildfire season, that used to be a few months long, is now like the entire year. And we've seen pictures on TV recently, and of course Australia had these tremendous wildfires. So we've got to start right away, and I'm hoping everybody listening to this program will really get involved and write letters, get to the politicians, speak to religious leaders, and saying, this is part of our religion. I mean, if it's not to save God's precious earth that he's given us, then what's it all about? And to really make it a central focus of everything we do today, because you say we may not be around
mm-hmm.
much longer, at least in the way we have things today. So, and if we don't solve this problem, everything else becomes secondary.
Right. So, are there rabbis who support vegetarianism?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's always all too few. But there's two in particular in the movie. There's Rabbi David Rosen, former chief rabbi of Ireland, and he's an outstanding spokesperson. Unfortunately, he is super busy, and I've often said if we can find a way of getting him the money to take a one-year leave of absence or something, that could really make a difference. Then also in the movie, there's a Rabbi Shai Yashab Cohen, who is the chief rabbi of Haifa, a city in Israel, of course. And, there's a number of others, and, we try to get them to speak out more, but, everybody's busy and stuff like that. But we definitely have this strong case. And as I said, I'm ready, although I'm what they call a Baal Teshuva, a returnee to Judaism, in terms of not being religious when I was young, and then getting into it shortly after getting married and reading about it and finding that Judaism does have these powerful teachings, unfortunately not always put into practice. And that's why I wrote that other book, Judaism and Global Survival, to show that these teachings can be applied to energy and pollution and hunger. And
So I think what you're saying is you're trying to work within the structure,
right,
within the tradition, mm-hmm, and say that it's already there, because I'm all about change and changing with the, mm-hmm, times, and there's a lot of information that's really not applicable anymore because it was written so long ago, but there are some that are still very adamant about sticking with their tradition, mm-hmm, tradition, and so when you bring up something that's different, they say that, you know, that changing is not, mm-hmm, acceptable.
Well, we've got to change with the times. Certainly when the Torah was written, they didn't have TV and computers and cars and stuff, so there is a way of adapting, and Judaism is a practical religion and tries to adapt to these things. But the thing is that, as you mentioned before, thankfully there's many, many good videos out there.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than trying to just have one more of that type, we decided, let me try to do it from a religious perspective. And, you know, at least work within the Jewish community, although, as I said, other religions have similar teachings, because a person in general, say a secular person, can say, well, you know, I enjoy meat and that's all I'm concerned about, whereas theoretically, at least, somebody who takes Judaism seriously should, you know, and tries to live up to the mitzvot or commandments, should take our challenge seriously, because we're saying that there are six important mandates, and these are fundamental. It's not like, gee, I found 13th century rabbi made one statement and all, but as I said, taking care of our health is arguably the most important commandment, and certainly compassion for animals, because as I indicated, God's compassion is over all of his creatures. There's many laws on that. The great Jewish heroes like Moses and King David were chosen because they show compassion to animals in their youth. And the environment, I mean, this is God's earth and all, and it says the earth is the Lord's, but we are to be co-workers with God in protecting the environment. And then the fourth one is conserving natural resources. There's a very powerful teaching in Deuteronomy, which says that even in warfare, you're not allowed to destroy fruit-bearing trees, build a battering ram to destroy an enemy fortification. And of course in Judaism it's the Bible, but also the commentaries, because often the Bible doesn't go into any detail. So this is, to me, is one of the greatest things they did, because the sages took that special prohibition which says you can't use an axe and destroy fruit trees in times of war, and they generalized that and said, well, if it's true in wartime, then it should be true at all times.
That's right.
And not just trees, but anything of value, and not just an axe, but in any way. So there's a general prohibition called Bal Tashchit, which means thou shalt not waste or unnecessarily destroy anything of value. And one of the rabbis indicated this means also using far more resources than is necessary. That's why I argue that animal-based agriculture violates that, because, as you know, far, far more water, far, far more energy, more land, wastefulness
of
grain. So
extremely wasteful.
There it is, all these commandments being violated. And going down the line, the fifth of these mandates is to help hungry people. And once again, it says in the prayers that you recite after eating a meal, God in his compassion has provided enough for all, and yet why is there so much starvation?
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason is, of course, 70% of those grains in the U.S. fed to animals destined for slaughter. The Bible says we should leave the corners of the field, the gleanings of the harvest, very much concerned about helping the hungry. And then seeking and pursuing peace, because the rabbis saw that the Hebrew word for bread, which is lechem, and war, milchama, they come from the same root, and from that they deduce that when there's a shortage of grain and other resources, people are more likely to go to war. And this is why I argue, because the animal-based diets are so wasteful, and, you know, when there's not enough, like it's not enough water in biblical days and now, not enough oil, people are more likely to go to war. We've seen that. So the slogan of the peace movement and the slogan of the vegetarian movement should be one and the same. all we're saying is give peas a chance. So we're trying to get that message out. And
that's great.
I can extend a little bit of a pun. If you take some peas and turn it around your head a few times, you can then, what will you then have? World peas.
World peas. There we go.
No. So, and we thought the problems of the world were difficult to solve. There it is. Right there.
Thank you. Yeah. Do you get a better response from the Reform Jews? There are the three groups, Orthodox, mm-hmm. Conservative, and Reformed, and they tend to be more forward-thinking, allowing more women to be rabbis.
Absolutely.
And cantors, and there are more gay communities that are allowed mm-hmm. in that group. I imagine right. they'd be more responsive to vegetarianism.
Well, you know, even more the Reconstructionists, that's a relatively small group, but somehow a lot of their rabbis are vegetarian. And it is true. I mean, two I mentioned before are Orthodox in Israel, Rabbi Rosen, former Chief Rabbi of Ireland, and Rabbi Shai Yash Cohen. But, you know, I wish more rabbis would be involved, would speak out. But I think probably Reformed, Conservative are more open. But when I wrote my book and we make the movie, we try to make it so that it's, nobody can say, well, that's good for Reform, but it's not good for Orthodox. You know, it is, I say, quote unquote, they stole my religion, because those who are most steeped in things, who are most knowledgeable about Jewish teachings, you would think would be the biggest challenges to the status quo and the typical diets, because they are so contrary to Jewish values. But unfortunately, said often, the ritual is stressed. Somebody said, we built fences around many ritual commandments. You know, it's important to keep them, so find a way. But relatively speaking, we're ignoring others, like that Bao Tashkit I just mentioned.
Yeah,
about
that's beautiful. I love that idea of not cutting down fruit trees and extending that to everything that's valuable.
Yeah. Can you imagine if the world took that seriously?
Well, people don't. If you calculated the value of a tree, the real value.
Oh, sure.
What it does in terms of cleansing the air and giving us oxygen, it's priceless. People doing return on investments on clearing an area, if they included the real value, we wouldn't be cutting any trees, bottom line.
Not only that, but can you imagine if people had to pay the real cost of their steaks and chicken dinners and everything? I mean, The pollution effects, global warming effects.
Absolutely.
And what it's doing psychologically to us by all the killing and slaughtering that's going on.
So here's another question. Why Israel is referred to as the land of milk and honey, is it not?
Yep.
What does that mean? To me, it's like animal bodily fluids and bee barf. Why does that have so much of appeal? Do you know where that originated?
Yeah, well, there's one group there, Neil Kadumin, that has a book, a lot of books on this, and has a place in Israel where they try to reestablish conditions. They have the trees and from the biblical times and all that. And one writer indicated that this represented the wildness of the land of Israel. This was honey from the bees and all, you know, matter of fact, when it talks about honey as part of the seven species, they were talking about date honey. And the milk is milk from the goats, but the goats, that's for the kids and all. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean that we should take eggs and milk from the animals. Matter of fact, this Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cohen Cook, known affectionately as Rob Cook, first chief rabbi of pre-state Israel and one of the great Jewish philosophers of the 20th century, thought, you know, taking milk from the animals is like a form of theft.
That's right.
So, so that can be interpreted as when the land was wild, in effect, and you had wild goats and bees and all, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we should take milk and honey from the animals.
Yeah, it's just one of those many images people have, picturesque images of wanting to keep things as they are because they don't want to see things as they really are.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right. So there's one of my favorite holidays is Passover, mm-hmm. and where we read the story of Moses and the Jewish slaves in Egypt, and Moses goes to the Pharaoh and tries to get the Jews out of Egypt, and then we have the 10 plagues, and then the parting of the Red Sea, and the Jews are liberated from slavery. And it's a great story, and it's great for children, telling the story and all the foods on the table that are symbolic of different things, and it's fun. But there's always this component to me that's missing. It talks about not forgetting what happened and how important it is, and it certainly is, but I always see the bigger picture. I see all people shouldn't be enslaved, not just the Jewish
Absolutely.
People, and all animals shouldn't
Absolutely.
Be enslaved.
Yep.
How do we get that message in there? It's so obvious to me, and yet after you go through this story, you sit down and have a dinner, mm-hmm. and the dinner has all of these tortured
mm-hmm.
foods. That
right. Well, it doesn't have to. You know, we can have vegetarian foods because, you know, I argue there's no need to eat meat today. And the fact that I mentioned this chief rabbi before, and the former chief rabbi of all of Israel, Shlomo Goren, strict vegetarian. So the thing is that Jews and everybody else has a choice. And I argue, shouldn't that choice be made taking into account the highest of ethical values, the highest religious values? Shouldn't we consider our health and how animals are treated and the devastation of the environment and the wasting of resources and the violation of all these biblical laws and laws of other religions that I've been talking about? So you're right. It's to me, somebody's called it the tragedy of religion, that we don't put into practice. And often I hear on a tape a rabbi talking about Judaism, wonderful teaching about animals, and it's true, as I said, God's mercies and for all his creatures, the righteous individual considers the lives of his or her animal. But then it's like right next door, it's being violated, in effect, or, you know, out in society in general. So that big, big word reality is often overlooked.
Yeah.
So the teachings are there, and I'm trying to get these out. As I say, I have these 140 articles. I send out a newsletter every week. If anybody wants to contact me, by the way, at president@JewishVeg, one word, Jewish followed by VG.com, be happy to put them on a list to get free newsletters. And, you know, just involved in every way. And I hope people will go to sacredduty.com and see that movie and request a copy and get it to others and maybe arrange a showing. And just in general, talk to your ministers, priests, rabbis, imams, other religious leaders, write letters, just because it's madness and sheer insanity. And somebody said we have to respond with another kind of madness, in effect, the madness of the biblical prophets, a moral kind of madness that mm-hmm. says we're just not going to stand for the status quo the way it is. Religion's wonderful if we put them into practice. Otherwise, it's like a mockery of God's name and all his... God's world threatened as never before, and how can any religion just stand by and let this happen and be, unfortunately, often part of the problem rather than a solution in terms of the diet and in terms of not doing enough to respond to global warming and other threats?
I would like to think that religion might be more popular than it is today if it actually mm-hmm. was true to its teachings.
Absolutely.
Because a lot of people turn away from it
right.
because it's meaningless.
Yeah, especially young, idealistic people. That's an argument I try to use all the time. You know, people always talk about outreach. How do we bring people back? Why is it that many of the synagogues, many of the churches are empty on the Sabbath days, etc.? So, you know, that would make it a lot more meaningful and also try to create conditions so that... churches and synagogues and other religious institutions can have a decent planet to continue their teaching.
That's right.
What's it all about? You know?
Well, you've done a tremendous amount of work, and you continue to do a tremendous amount of work. All the articles and the books you've written, It's really a wonderful thing, and people just need to look for it because it's there. All the information is there, and we just need to find more ways to talk about it and get it out there. So thank you so much for everything that you're doing.
Well, thank you for...
Thank you so much for talking to me today. And for those of you who are listening, don't forget to check those websites, jewishveg.com and asacredduty.com. And I'm Karen Hartglass.
Thank you.
And thank you, Dr. Schwartz.
My pleasure.
This has been... I'll be back next week. Thank you.